It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, there's talk about whether Wisconsin needs a public newspaper. We'll hear some of the reasons why.
First, former Senator Russ Feingold is gearing up for a likely rematch against Senator Ron Johnson in the 2016 election. He lost to Johnson in the 2010 Tea Party wave after 18 years as a U.S. senator. He announced his campaign in May.
Feingold made his first campaign policy speech this week and released his first radio ad, focusing on economic issues, including a call for a $15 federal minimum wage. Yesterday, Marquette Law School released its latest poll, showing that his lead over Johnson had dropped significantly since April. This comes after 2 months of criticism from Republicans over how he raised and spent money while out of office.
Here with us now is former Senator Russ Feingold. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be on the show.
Well, the National Journal ranked Senator Johnson's seat as one of the two most likely seats in the country to flip in the 2016 elections. In April of this year, the Marquette Law poll showed you leading Senator Johnson by 16 points. But according to the latest Marquette poll out just yesterday, that lead is down to 5 points. What happened?
Well, listen, to be ahead of an incumbent senator at any point in the campaign is very exciting. But, you know, that's not what this is about. That's sort of Washington insider talk back and forth. You know, what this is about is whether the people of Wisconsin are going to be properly represented. And that's why I've been going to all 72 counties in the state. Before the end of the month, I will have been to all of them and ask people what is their concern now. And you know what? Nobody mentions polls. Nobody mentions this or that. They talk about their economic well-being. We feel very good about how our campaign is going, but that's because it's about the challenges that middle class and working families are facing to make ends meet. So my view is this should be about the people of the state. That's why I'm running.
Now, over the past few months, you've taken some criticism for the way that you and your organizations have raised and have spent money. Now, critics have said you're the guy who said he wanted to get big money out of politics. But while you were out of office, you accepted over $100,000 in speaking fees. Now, this is something you'd been outspoken against for judges and politicians, and you used funds raised for your political action campaign committee, mostly for fundraising and for salaries. So how do you respond to critics who say that those moves represent a big departure from what you've stood for in the past?
Well, they're not a departure at all. Those stories are completely inaccurate. My position against honoraria had to do with people in public office. In other words, judges getting honorariums or politicians getting honorariums when they're in office. What I've done since I've been out of the Senate is I've been asked by various educational institutions like Marquette University Law School, Lawrence University, and various schools around the country if I would come and speak to their students. And it was usually because the students had requested that I be the speaker. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And I'm proud to have done it. So, frankly, that's almost a goofy criticism because the whole basis of this issue is what people in public office do. You're in public office, the public is paying your salary. I've been in the private sector during this period, so it doesn't really apply. So, again, what this is just an attempt by the Republicans to get away from the fact that the issues addressing economic well-being for Wisconsin families aren't being addressed by the incumbent senator, who is a person of great privilege, who tends to focus on voting for corporations and multimillionaires and billionaires, and Owen opposes things like a federal minimum wage. He thinks we shouldn't have student loans helped by the federal government. So these are the real issues, and I'm completely proud and comfortable with the approach I've taken for the last 2 years.
Because this has been a persistent issue, I want to ask you, as you chose to accept those speaking fees, did you, for example, know then that you'd be challenging Ron Johnson down the road to get your old Senate seat back?
Absolutely not. I had no idea. First of all, there would be nothing wrong with that. The fact is, I didn't run several times for office when people requested me to. People asked me to run for the Senate in 2012. People were asking me to run for governor. It was not my intention to run for office again. I just didn't think about it a great deal because I was doing other things. But then I saw what had happened to the people of the state. I saw the attack by these big money interests from out of the state that support Scott Walker and Ron Johnson. I saw the attempt to divide and conquer people in this state. And you know, about a year ago, I realized, you know, I need to be one of the persons to try to help turn this around, to get back to our common values of the environment, the university, and mutual respect in the state. So it was at that point that I started thinking seriously about running again. For many years, I assumed I would not run again.
Now, people may hold you to a different standard because money in politics has been the major calling card of your career. Is it fair for people to hold you to the ideals of keeping money out of politics? And should you be elected, would that continue to be an issue for you?
Oh, they should hold me to the highest standard, and I have met that standard with every issue you've mentioned. Every single thing we've done with our organization when we were with the Progressives United, my own personal conduct, has been legal, ethical, effective at the highest standard, and I am very proud of all that activity. So I have no problem with being held to a high standard, and I have achieved it.
We're talking with former Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold about his campaign for 2016 to try to win his old Senate seat back from Ron Johnson. Now, recently you said that you're not going to follow a pledge you made in 1992 to raise the majority of your campaign funds from within the state of Wisconsin because of changes to campaign finance laws made since you made that pledge. What's changed since then?
Well, how about 23 years and a few Supreme Court decisions? It is the height of absurdity to suggest that things that were decided or proposed in 1992, which I lived up to each time I ran, should still apply. Because what happened in 2009? The Supreme Court decided to overturn the law of the land that had been in place since 1907. It said that corporations could use unlimited campaign contributions to destroy our political process. So it would be silly for somebody to still apply these rules or these pledges of the past that are not anything that I pledged for this campaign. I have got a far greater amount of contributions from Wisconsinites than Ron Johnson. It might be 10 times to one. But you know what? If people around the country want to send me $25 or $50 to add on to what we get from people in Wisconsin, I encourage them to, because how else are we going to take on the corporations, billionaires, the Koch brothers? It'd be pretty dumb of us to just sit back and let them strangle our democracy. So a pledge in 1992 doesn't make a whole lot of sense after Citizens United is fully implemented.
Now, admittedly, 1992 is a long time ago, but isn't the reason for that original pledge still in place that if you raise most of your money from outside Wisconsin, you could be held accountable to out-of-state interests?
Oh, sure. If you are wholly dependent on out-of-state interests, I have one of the highest percentages of any person running for office in the country terms of the Senate for in-state contributions. We're talking about 45%. And my opponent, Ron Johnson, our likely opponent, actually has less from Wisconsin. He relies heavily on out-of-state contributions and has welcomed these huge hidden contributions from around the country. The Club for Growth just announced this week they're going to do $2.5 million for his campaign. That's not a Wisconsin organization primarily. So, to me, this is the kind of principle we should follow. And if we can overturn Citizens United, which we need to do, I hope to get back to the day in the future when it's possible for people to run a strong campaign with contributions, a majority from their own home state. But it's not possible right now because of the corporate contributions.
So is the way that you're fundraising right now, including out-of-state money, still categorically different from the way Ron Johnson is raising his money?
He is raising more from out-of-state. We have a higher percentage of in-state than Ron Johnson does. We have 10 times more contributions from Wisconsin citizens than he does. So, yes, it's entirely different. He's far more out-of-state based. And, frankly, his contributions are from much wealthier people who give a lot more money. We have a much lower average contribution, so I'm very proud of that.
Now, I want to ask you about Wisconsin. After you left the Senate, you weren't a big presence in Wisconsin politics for several years. You worked in the State Department in Africa. You were not a vocal part of the Act 10 conflict between unions and Republicans. And you recently tweeted that the spirit of unity is still Wisconsin's guiding principle. Now, that tweet comes at a time when a lot of people say the state has never been more divided. And what would you say to people who wonder if you've lost touch with where today's Wisconsin is?
It's really ironic that you say that, because the reason I say that is that I've been all over the state many times in the last 4 years. And what I've seen is consistent, and I have been around the state a majority of the time, is that people are telling me that the state has been terribly divided. What I'm saying is the spirit of unity of the average citizen is still there. And it's one of the reasons we're doing very well in this campaign, is because people want somebody who's going to be positive and forward-looking. They want that spirit of unity back. So most people I talk to, I don't know who you talk to, but most people I talk to don't want us to have these divisions. Every day somebody tells me they have arguments at family dinners that didn't used to occur because of all this. So I'm trying to fight the divisiveness that has occurred and bring people together. And I am more in touch, certainly, than the incumbent senator. Right now, I will have soon been at all 72 counties listening to people. I'm not sure he's even done that at any point during the first 4 years he was in office. I'm pretty sure he hasn't. So I can tell you what I'm reporting to you is the actual view of the people of the state, and got to be one of the only persons who's been around to actually listen to everybody in every county.
Now, how would you plan to fight the divisiveness that we see in Wisconsin politics right now that a lot of people say is pretty entrenched and worse than it's been in a while?
Well, that's a sort of a defeatist attitude. This is a great state. People of this state care deeply about the environment, our natural resources, and most people, Republican or Democrat, are willing to work together on that if people don't try to make it a political issue. Most people in the state really care deeply about higher education, making sure students have an opportunity to get loans if they need it to get to go to college. Care deeply about our University of Wisconsin system that's been brutally attacked by the Walker administration. So I think there's a lot of areas of consensus, but most importantly, people want leaders now in 2015 going into 2016 who want to work for everybody. What Ron Johnson and Scott Walker like to do is figure out how they can just get the majority of people and then sort of denigrate and attack the rest of the people, whether they're public employees or people who work in factories, or whether it's university professors, or whether it's people in public office. They like to sort of make fun of other people's professions that aren't in their coalition. I believe that somebody who represents the people of the state has to represent everybody, even the people that were against them in the campaigns. And that's a value that Wisconsin used to have and that I hope to play a role in bringing back.
Let's talk a little bit of policy before I let you go. You came out this week in support of a $15 minimum wage at the federal level. This is something we talked about on Central Time a bit earlier this week. And according to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, a living wage in Wisconsin is around $9 or $10 an hour because both wages and the cost of living here are lower than in other places, big cities on the coast. So do you think there could be a negative economic impact on Wisconsin if the federal minimum wage is raised too high?
I think there'd be an excellent positive impact on the state of Wisconsin if we were able to get to a $50 minimum wage. Because those people are going to buy things. They're going to buy the products that these companies make. If you are able to get people to have a decent income, where they are able to pay their bills and have some extra money to buy other things, that's the best thing that can happen to the economy. And I think in Wisconsin, most people, certainly if they work hard, should be paid up to $15 an hour as a minimum. I think that that is something that hard work should be rewarded.
Senator Feingold, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Nice talking to you.
We've been speaking to former Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold. He's running to win back the Senate seat he lost to Senator Ron Johnson in 2010. He launched his campaign in May. In an age of dwindling newspaper subscriptions and newsrooms paring down the number of reporters on staff, our next guest says we can't just leave the survival of good journalism to the market.
So he has an idea, a Wisconsin public newspaper paid for by taxpayer money and private donations.
Dave Cheslevich joins us now. He writes the Citizen Dave blog for the Madison website Isthmus. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So Dave, why do we need a Wisconsin public newspaper?
Well, you know, an informed public is crucial to a healthy democracy. And the most fundamental thing about having an informed public is to have strong daily newspapers. And unfortunately, what we've seen in the past couple of decades in this country is a steady dwindling of newspapers, daily newspapers. One estimate is that one-fifth of all journalists who were employed 10 years ago are no longer working at newspapers. And we've seen this in Wisconsin with the loss of the Milwaukee Sentinel, folded into the Journal Sentinel now. The Cap Times in Madison is a shadow of what it once was, no longer publishes a daily newspaper. And so my argument is that because journalism is so important to a healthy democracy, we should look at some other models that have been successful. And, you know, I'm on one right now. Wisconsin Public Radio is a great source of reliable information. It's funded by a mix of public support, whether that be from the government or private individuals and a variety of other sources. And it works. It works very well. And so I just wanted to throw out a provocative idea. This isn't a business plan. I can't answer all the details and how it might work. But I do think it's time for us to start looking at new models.
Well, speaking of new models, there are alternatives to newspapers. There are blogs. There are television shows. There's radio stations. Why not lean more on those if people are expressing a preference through the market not to buy and read newspapers?
Sure, and those all can be sources of information. But I write a blog, and I know that I couldn't write that blog, the Citizen Day blog, without the kind of real journalism that gets produced every day in places like Wisconsin Public Radio and frankly, in what remains of the daily newspapers. I read those newspapers every day. I read the New York Times. And it's the information I glean from those sources that allows me to opine in my blog. But I do very little in the way of actual reporting of news. And so it concerns me a little bit that people, I wouldn't want my blog to be a news source, a primary news source for my readers. I hope that people have already read the story that I'm commenting on, and then they can read what I write about it and take it with a grain of salt, agree, not agree, whatever. But so much of what we have today falls in the category of commentary or in the category of entertainment. And what we're lacking is hard, objective, traditional news.
And do you think people in Wisconsin or any state that matter facing a similar situation with its newspapers would be willing to step up and help fund a public newspaper?
Well, again, you know, I didn't intend this to be a specific proposal with a business plan intact. And I know that given this current legislature and their cuts to Wisconsin Public Radio and television, that this particular government, state government, isn't likely to do that. But 37% of Wisconsin Public Radio's funding comes from listeners. And so some sort of arrangement where people could subscribe to a publicly owned entity that would have as its first mission providing good, solid information, journalism in the best sense, I think is doable, whether or not it's actually just like Wisconsin Public Radio or not.
Dave, can you point us to other models that are similar that might point the way for an idea like this, a public newspaper?
Sure. I mean, there's a number of them. They don't quite reach the level of what I had in mind. But take, for example, the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Now, that's funded through grants and foundations. Both the State Journal and the Cap Times Foundations have, to their credit, supported that service. But that works more like the AP Wire, for example. So they provide content that newspapers can pick up, but it's not a newspaper in its own right. They do very good work in investigative journalism. It's funded, again, through foundations. It's not a pure market model, but it does provide some of the content that I have in mind for this kind of daily publication.
Now, in your piece, you lament a bit the loss of some veteran reporters in the Madison area where you live. Do you think having a public newspaper could theoretically give people like that a home and more job security?
I think so. I know an awful lot of good journalists who are no longer writing news. They've gone to public relations or they're doing something else entirely, not because they didn't love journalism, but because they simply couldn't make a living in that profession. And again, as I think I mentioned earlier, something like one-fifth of all journalists who were employed 10 years ago are no longer working. So when you've got a newsroom, and I think the newsrooms here in Madison actually have been hit much harder than that, but when you have a newsroom that's at least 20% smaller than it was 10 years ago, obviously that's fewer people that you can send to all kinds of public meetings and events and do investigative reporting. It just means that we know a lot less about our communities, about our local governments, about all kinds of things going on. That is dangerous, frankly. If an uninformed electorate is going to be an electorate that is easily led astray.
Have you gotten any response to your piece? People who sought you out and said, that's a great idea. Maybe we do need to look at something like that.
Yeah, I got that response, and I got other responses. some of both. I mean, some folks, you know, the criticism, I mean, some folks compared my idea to Pravda. the was the mouthpiece of the Soviet government. But that's not what I had.
Sorry, Dave, I think we're losing you there. I think we're going to have to say goodbye, but we got a lot in there. Thank you so much for joining us, Dave. That was Dave Cheslevich. He writes the Citizen Dave blog for the Madison website Isthmus. He joined us to talk about a recent column that he wrote expressing his idea that in an era of struggling newspaper subscriptions, some veteran journalists leaving the field, that maybe, he thinks, the time has come for a public newspaper. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Rob Ferret will be back on Monday.
Yesterday was the start of this year's Sun Prairie Sweet Corn Festival. It's an annual celebration of one of the summer's most well-known and delicious vegetables, sweet corn.
So we asked Food Friday regular Lori Skelton to come up with some sweet corn recipes. She's with us now to share what she's been working on.
And we want to hear from you on this, too. Are you excited that it is finally sweet corn season? What's your favorite way to have the summer treat? How do you usually prepare your sweet corn? People get very particular about the way that they like to cook their corn. Let us know yours. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lori Skelton is one of WPR's in-house foodies, and she joins us once a month for Food Friday. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
And a sweet welcome back it is.
A sweet corn welcome back. Before we can start enjoying that sweet corn, we need to get some first. How would you recommend we choose a good ear or dozen ears?
First of all, drive to the Delavan Inlet and visit the sweet corn lady.
The sweet corn lady.
This is the sweet corn I grew up with. I grew up about a mile away from the Delavan Inlet, and it started off as a woman with sweet corn in the back of her truck, and I gather she's now working with her children and her grandchildren. And, yeah, it's just a lovely stand that says the sweet corn lady, because that's how we all knew her. Some of the best corn around. But if you can't get to the Delavan Inlet, you're looking for an ear that feels plump. You want the husk to be bright green. It should feel slightly damp when you're at the farmer's market. The tassels should be brown and a little bit sticky. If they're too pale or too dark, then you don't have the right ear of corn. And keep your eye out for tiny little brown holes in the husk. That's a sign of worms, and obviously you don't want wormy corn. So that's how you can pick a decent ear of corn without having to strip the husks from everything, which, I mean, it's efficient, but it does tend to get you really dirty looks at the market.
And there are a lot of different ways to prepare that corn once we've got it, and boiling is sort of your standby. You just want to eat some sweet corn quickly. You toss it in your boiling water. What are the rules for how to cook corn when you're cooking it in boiling water?
This is where things can get a little bit tricky. The old rule is when you had corn in your backyard, you put your water on to boil, then you go pick your sweet corn and husk it and throw it in. The water should be boiling. The water should have salt in it. And usually about 10 minutes of boiling will get you decent corn. Unless you were my father, who insisted on having the oldest ears possible and boiling them to blazes. He liked having tougher corn. Whereas my current beau happens to love younger ears, boiled just briefly, or thrown on the grill. Mm. And so right here, you've got so many individual variations as to what is the proper way to cook sweet corn. I tend not to like it as tough as my dad did, but then again, I also like having a little bit of sweetness. And here again, which do you pick? Do you get your standard, older, straight yellow ear? Do you get the bicolor? Do you go all out for super sweet, pale yellow? Mm-hmm. There are so many variations these days on corn. It can be a lot of fun if you don't mind experimenting.
So we talked about boiling. You just mentioned grilling, which is really great too. But there are even other methods. There's steaming, even microwaving, roasting.
You know, I've seen the microwave corn, and I'm told it's a great way to really get your husks clean, get all of the corn silk off. I've yet to try it. we've been doing a lot of corn on the grill this summer. The season started a little early for us, and we've been throwing ears of corn on the grill in the backyard. When we go out to American Players Theater, we're even including that in our picnics right now. So I'm stuck with those two methods, and I really don't want to change.
So when you say throwing them on the grill, are you leaving them in the husk? Are you husking them first?
I husk mine first and wrap them in foil if they're going to American Players Theater. In the backyard, I'll take the first couple of layers of husk off, but just leave a little bit on, pull the silk off, and then grill them in the husk over the coals.
And what about your favorite corn accoutrements, your corn toppings? Are you a purist with just the butter and the salt, or what do you like?
I'm so much of a purist that if I know the corn is really, really sweet, sometimes I don't even put anything on it, not even salt.
Wow.
Then, too, I also like the combination of sweet and heat. And one of my favorite things to whip up for corn on the grill is butter with sriracha mixed into it.
Ooh.
You'll put sriracha on anything, though.
Not quite anything.
We know you, Lori.
But almost. But that gets into something that is an absolute delight that you can sort of mock up in Wisconsin, and that's Mexican street corn, which is corn that's been grilled in the husk, and then you strip the husk back, so that's sort of your handle. And then you slather it in either mayonnaise or Mexican crema, and you sprinkle on plenty of chili powder and a little bit of lime juice, and then the finely grated cotija cheese. And you can even get cotija cheese that's not so finely grated, that's got a texture that's more like feta. And you can make a corn salad with that and the cheese and the chili and the lime. If you aren't going to be walking around and holding your cob of corn, you can actually make a salad that's fork-friendly with the same combination.
That sounds super yummy.
It's a really nice, again, that idea of sweet and heat, and of course the dairy, your fat with your sugar is always a fun combination. So you've got it all right there.
Well, we'll talk more about cooking with corn, but can we also enjoy it raw?
It depends on what you mean by enjoy. I've actually found more animals tend to enjoy. My cat actually likes, if you actually leave some sweet corn out, she will actually snack on a raw cob of corn. I suppose you can eat it raw. I personally find that it tends to upset my stomach if I do that.
Okay.
Have you ever tried it?
Yes. Actually, I was going to say I actually really like it. And what I do is I cut the kernels off of the cob raw, mix it with some cherry tomatoes that are cut in half, and put it in a vinaigrette with fresh garlic.
Oh, but you see, you're using a vinaigrette.
Yes.
And so
it is cooking it, quote unquote.
It is definitely changing some of the structure and some of the enzymes. I think for me, you know, just straight raw corn, there's something in that. Again, I really should be checking some of the science behind some of this, but there's something in it that just does not do nice things to my digestive tract.
So you guys were saying that the acid in the vinaigrette
exactly,
is like a ceviche would
exactly.
affect.
Exactly.
Got it. Okay. Interesting. Well, you didn't eat a lot of raw corn for this, Lori, or prepare it. What you did was you gave us two amazing things, sweet corn ice cream and some pies with corn.
Knowing that the festival was going on this weekend, this does happen sometimes. You cook up a bunch of corn for the gang that's coming over, and everybody said, oh yeah, I want 2 or 3 ears, and then they only eat one. So you're left with all of this cooked corn. What do you do with it? Since you've got an increase in sweetness because the corn has already been cooked and it's been sitting out for a while, I started thinking about desserts, and I did come up with a pretty decent sweet corn ice cream, which I brought in to work, and 3/4 of the people who tasted it said, this is delicious. Can we make it caramel corn? And we got a bunch of suggestions going around, and if you're in the mood for caramel corn ice cream, I would suggest you try 3 things. Either make sweet corn ice cream and use caramel sauce to make a sundae. Use cinnamon and maybe a little nutmeg to give it a spiciness without adding any extra calories. Or really go scone on it and sweeten it with maple syrup rather than sugar.
Hmm. Huh. What would
so
that
you get
do?
The sweetness and the flavor.
You get the sweetness and the flavor of something, especially if you're if you've got a smokier maple syrup. I think that would go a long way toward mimicking the flavor of caramel corn in ice cream. I didn't have a chance to try it, but there, corn is used in desserts throughout Latin America, and there's one from Venezuela. I think it's pronounced majarete, which is sweet corn kernels and coconut with coconut milk for a corn pudding that sounds out of this world. If anyone's made it, call in. I want to pick your brain on that.
Well, if you think about, you know, sort of your classic corn souffle, it kind of rides that line between savory and sweet.
Do you do a corn souffle with or without cornmeal in the roux?
It's been a while since I made it, but I think there may have been some cornmeal in there.
Okay. See, to me, that gets closer to an American spoon bread rather than a souffle.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, they're absolutely delicious, but there again, you're definitely going to be playing down the sweetness. The last time I made a spoon bread, I had bacon in it, so definitely staying away from the sweeter side of corn. The other thing that I made for us this week was a variation on the corn and lobster tart that Florence Fabricant had in the New York Times a little while ago. Yeah, you can get lobster in Wisconsin, but that's not something that tends to show up a lot. So I did start with good Wisconsin smoked trout. I also made a variation with crab meat, the inexpensive crab claw meat that you can get in cans, and the trout tart with sweet corn. Not as eggy as a quiche, so it had more of the corn, more of the fish in it. And the smoked trout variation had a robust taste to it, but a very light texture. It would be great for dinner, while the one with crab, I think, would be the perfect centerpiece for a lunch.
They were both delicious, or at least I only tried one, but I actually am
well,
saying...
Well, you tried one, and I tried the other, and we both think that they
trout,
were delicious.
Right,
so,
yeah.
And actually, one of the interesting things that you said, Lori, was that the fish and the crab call for different herbs, and what would you pair with each?
I think the crab would go really, really well with tarragon. Lobster and tarragon was what was suggested in the original recipe. If you were going to use the smoked salmon or smoked trout or even poached salmon, there I'd go with dill. But again, the recipe that we've got up on the Central Time website and the Facebook page has got the basic recipe and some suggestions. What turned out to be really, really lovely about this recipe is that every person who tried it had a very different take on it. Some were more fans of the trout, some were more fans of the crab. Some wanted more herbs, some wanted less, some wanted more heat, some wanted less. So take this basic recipe and do your own thing with it. I think you can have a lot of fun with it.
We're talking to Food Friday regular Lori Skelton about sweet corn now, and we'd like to hear from you.
What's your favorite way to prepare sweet corn? How do you incorporate sweet corn into your cooking when it's in season, which is now? And any advice on how to serve or to eat sweet corn? We're picking up our discussion about sweet corn right now with our Food Friday regular Lori Skelton. This weekend is the Sun Prairie Sweet Corn Festival.
And we want to hear from you, too. What's your favorite recipe for sweet corn? How do you like to eat it? Do you throw it on the grill? Do you boil it? Have you tried microwaving it? What questions do you have about cooking with sweet corn? You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Well, we talked about the corn and fish and crab tarts before the break, but, you know, the kernels are the most commonly used parts of an ear of corn, but there are other parts to use as well. What do you do with the milk that comes out of the raw kernels?
Are you talking about once you've cut the kernels off the cob, putting those cobs in water and making stock? Or are you talking about actually putting kernels in with water in a blender and making corn milk?
Why don't you tell us about both?
Corn milk is actually something that's been sold as a milk substitute, usually in Asian countries for a while. You can make this as thick or as thin as you want. The general recipe is like 1 cup of water for every ear of corn. And you put water and corn kernels in a blender, blend it up, strain out the corn meat, if you will, and then use it in muffins or whatever. But this is something that can sit for a couple of days in your refrigerator, and you can also freeze it. And I know that it has a similar texture and flavor to horchata, especially if you put cinnamon and honey in it, but it's a little bit lighter. And some people say it flat out tastes better. So that's one way to do corn milk. Corn cobs as a stock is a really good idea. Once you've cut the kernels off the ears, you put your cobs in a big pot, cover them with water, and you bring them to a boil, then take it down to a simmer. You're going to need about 45 minutes to an hour to get a really decent flavor. What's nice about using corn cobs for stock is that once you've got your stock, take the cobs out, you can then reduce it and then freeze it. Takes up less space in your freezer, and then when you come time to bring it out, just reconstitute it with more water. So that's cobs that you use in other preparations. I actually love making corn husk stock. This is going to be lighter in texture. It's absolutely clear, whereas corn cob stock can be a little bit cloudy. Mm. So easy. It's clean corn husks in water, maybe a little bit of onion, maybe a little bit of salt if you want a little extra flavor. You simmer it very, very gently, and this is a lovely, clear, straight corn tasting but lighter textured stock. If you've got just a few wild mushrooms, if you've been foraging, if you found just a few at the farmer's market, and you want to turn this into a really great starter, it's an absolute fantastic base for a wild mushroom soup. No cream, just this delicate corn stock, and if you found chanterelles or something, this is a really great way to show them off.
Interesting. Well, let's go to our callers now. We've got Michael joining us from New Berlin. Michael, hi.
Hi. I had a question about growing corn on the cob. It's one of my favorite things to do, and usually we soak it in water, but lately I've been trying to brine it in order to add a little more flavor, because I don't add butter, I don't add salt aftertaste. It's so good just grilled. And I'm wondering if there's a technique, or if brining is something I made up, or is that a usual thing?
Are you husking it completely?
No, we're keeping the husk on, soaking it in the salt water, and I'll gently squeeze the husk while it's still on the cob so that some of the salt water goes in, into the corn cob itself. And after it's soaked for a little while, you throw it on the grill that way, and there is no better way to have sweet corn in Wisconsin than grilled, in my opinion.
Okay. And you notice a difference in the taste?
I haven't yet. That's why I wonder if I'm doing something wrong, because I would think that brining would add flavor, add a little bit of saltiness without being overwhelming. And that's what I was asking about, if I'm doing it wrong. Just corn on the cob grilled is wonderful.
Absolutely.
Having to add a little bit of salt flavor by brining the water, and I don't see notice, I think, but I'm just looking for an expert's opinion.
Well, I know brining can help with flavor when you're brining proteins. I don't know if the structure of a corn kernel is going to let that much of the salt get into it.
That's what I was thinking. There's not much permeability.
We do that at my house, though. That's how I was brought up, boiling corn. We do the same thing, parboiling it before throwing it on the grill.
Oh, okay.
We husk it, though.
There you go.
And I think maybe that lets there be a little more saturation into the cob.
And you're parboiling it. Mm-hmm. So right there, you're adding heat. That's going to change the structure right there. I don't know if it's going to do that much for you. I'd say go ahead and add the salt later. Or if you want to get really, really fancy, there are a number of flavored salts out right now. That might be something that would add a little bit more of a jazz to your corn.
Nice. Well, good luck with that, Michael. Enjoy your corn.
And I have to say, we've talked a lot about butter on corn, but being married to a Frenchman who follows more of the Mediterranean, he does really good olive oil on the corn on the cob instead of butter.
Okay. I would imagine it tastes delicious, but I know how messy it is when you butter your corn. How the heck do you keep olive oil from not getting all over your shirt?
Well, if you're asking me, I would say it's impossible, but he manages to do it. So, but yeah, it's a little different flavor profile.
So would you use a stronger sturdier olive oil or something that's more delicate and fruity?
I think either could work. I mean, I think the one that we tend to have is a little more fruity, but I think either could work.
And Lori, just very briefly before we let you go, what about putting some herbs in your butter? Maybe some basil butter on corn.
Absolutely.
That can't be wrong.
Compound butters are always fun to have, and this is a great time of the year to start thinking about that. If you've got extra herbs in your garden, get an extra pound of butter, soften it up, make up some logs of compound butter and stash them in the freezer. But, basil with corn is, yes, so, 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 so good. And if you don't mind it, if you're talking about smoky flavors on the grill, sage is a good one. If you've got fresh sage, you may want to husk your corn almost to complete, stick a few leaves of sage in, then put the husk back on, throw that on the grill, and see what happens.
Well, Lori, thanks so much for being with us today.
Absolutely.
That was Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies. She joins us once a month for Food Friday. She was with us to talk about sweet corn just in time for the Sun Prairie Sweet Corn Festival this weekend. You can find out about the festival and Lori's corn and fish tart recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. Drinking water is a concern around the world, but there's a fascinating new development on that front.
A researcher at Carnegie Mellon University has created a book that can help, and it's not just a book that explains how to purify water, it actually purifies water.
So the book's pages are laced with silver nanoparticles, which have been shown to be very effective in killing waterborne microbes. So the user reads the instructions printed on the page and then soaks it in the water.
Kind of amazing stuff, and I could see some interesting variations on that, like maybe a cookbook that has the spices and seasonings locked into the pages.
Or maybe a bartending guide that has bitters or other interesting infusions right in the pages. Of course, you could only make one of those and then you wouldn't have the instructions anymore.
Who knows, though? This could be a boost for book sales, help out those brick-and-mortar bookstores out there.
You know, the only risk would be if there's a chance of rain when you're on your way home with your book, because you'd get home and there'd be nothing left.
We'll take our chances. Well, exciting stuff on the way in the world of books.